Today is May the 19th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Colonial Pipeline. What do we know so far about the perpetrators? Colonial Pipeline was the victim of a ransomware attack in which the hackers stole nearly 100 gigabytes of data, a breach that caused the company to shut down operations of the biggest fuel pipeline in the United States. The hackers were using the servers that were disabled as a repository for storing information before relaying it to computers in Russia. Colonial Pipeline was able to recover some stolen data because of intervention, which stopped the flow of stolen data believed to be headed to Russia, the ultimate destination. The takedown, which occurred on May the 8th, was enacted by companies that included operators of United States-based servers used by the hackers. The intervention involved the White House, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and National Security Agency, and shut off key servers used by the hackers. But Colonial Pipeline data hadn't yet been sent, which allowed investigators to retrieve it. The takedown represents an unusually swift response to a cyber attack that had an uncommonly large impact, throttling gasoline supplies across the eastern United States and threatening a spike in prices. The FBI confirmed that attackers used DarkSide ransomware in the attack. Others have linked the attack to a ransomware group using the same name. Among the evidence linking the group to Russia is its use of the Russian language and its exclusion of Russian companies as hacking targets. They stole nearly 100 gigabytes of data from Colonial's network before locking up computers with ransomware and demanding payment. Colonial shut down its computer network and the pipeline's operations while it assessed the damage. In the aftermath of the takedown, DarkSide issued a statement on the dark web hinting at contrition. "We are apolitical. We do not participate in geopolitics. Our goal is to make money and not creating problems for society. From today, we introduce moderation and check each company that our partners want to encrypt to avoid social consequences in the future." Cybercrime group DarkSide said it had lost control of its web servers and some of the money it's made off ransom payments. After the FBI confirmed that the gang was behind the $5 million ransomware attack on Colonial Pipeline that spurred gas shortages and panic buying across the Southeast. Analysts at security research firm FireEye said that the messages are circulating in multiple cyber criminal forums that say DarkSide has shut down amid pressure from the United States and law enforcement. It remains unclear if the announcement is just a ruse for the group to escape attention or avoid paying its partners. Cybersecurity analysts warn that anything posted by DarkSide operators should be taken with a grain of salt. DarkSide also claimed that cryptocurrency funds were withdrawn from the hackers group payment server, which hosted ransom payments made by victims such as Colonial Pipeline, the report said. The funds which the group is typically supposed to split between itself and its partners were transferred to an unknown wallet. Mandiant, that's M-A-N-D-I-A-N-T, Mandiant Threat Intelligence, which is a subsidiary of FireEye, said DarkSide shared a statement with its criminal partners announcing that it would shut down. They stated that they lost access to the infrastructure, including their blog, payment, and CDN servers, and would be closing their service. The post cited law enforcement pressure and pressure from the United States for this decision. These claims have not yet been independently validated, and there is some speculation by some that this could be an exit scam. According to the messages shared on the cybercrime forums, they said victims of the criminal group who had not paid ransom would be given decryptors to get the stolen data back. The wallet used by DarkSide Ransomware Group to receive Bitcoin ransom payments has been identified, according to data analysis firm Elliptic, citing intelligence collection and analysis of blockchain transactions. Elliptic said in its report, the wallet received 75 Bitcoin payments reportedly made by Colonial Pipeline on May the 8th, following the cyber attack that led to widespread fuel shortages in the United States. Who is Elliptic? They were founded in 2013. Elliptic pioneered in the use of blockchain analytics for financial crime compliance. They are the leading provider of crypto compliance solutions globally, bringing compliance to crypto assets. Elliptic followed the Bitcoin ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline and other DarkSide ransom victims. Elliptic's business is cryptocurrency forensics, investigations, compliance, and sanctions. Elliptic's analysis revealed it was DarkSide, the cybercrime group that held the United States energy infrastructure for ransom. Elliptic had identified the Bitcoin wallet used by DarkSide ransom group to receive ransom payments from its victims based on their intelligence collection and analysis of blockchain transactions. Their analysis shows that the wallet had been active since March the 4th of this year and had received 57 payments from 21 different wallets. Some of these payments directly match ransoms known to have been paid to DarkSide by other victims. In total, the DarkSide wallet had received Bitcoin transactions since March with a total value of $17.5 million. Ransoms associated with previous attacks were paid to other wallets. Elliptic also used blockchain analysis to follow the money trail and determine where DarkSide is sending its ransomware proceeds to launder them or convert them to cash. It has been reported that DarkSide itself has ceased operations and has had its funds seized, and indeed their wallet was emptied of the $5 million in Bitcoin. There has been speculation that the Bitcoins were seized by the U.S. government. If that is the case, they didn't actually seize most of Colonial Pipeline's ransom payment. The majority of that was probably moved out of the wallet on May the 9th. But by tracing previous outflows from the wallet, they gained insights into how DarkSide and its affiliates were laundering their previous proceeds. What they found was that 18% of the Bitcoin was sent to a small group of exchanges. This information provided law enforcement with critical leads to identify the perpetrators of these attacks. An additional 4% had been sent to Hydra, the world's largest darknet marketplace, servicing customers in Russia and neighboring countries. As was revealed in previous research, Hydra offers cash-out services alongside narcotics, hacking tools, and fake IDs. These allow Bitcoin to be converted into gift vouchers, prepaid debit cards, or cash rubles. If you're a Russian cyber criminal and you want to cash out your crypto, then Hydra is an attractive option. By identifying this wallet, Elliptic's clients, including financial institutions, crypto exchanges, and financial tech organizations, will now be alerted to any client deposits that originate from the DarkSide wallet. By using their transaction and wallet screening tools, they can ensure that DarkSide and other ransomware operators cannot cash out or exchange the Bitcoin proceeds. Elliptic's law enforcement clients can also use the software to trace these funds and seek to identify those responsible for those crippling cyber attacks. The wallet has been active since March and has received 57 payments from 21 different wallets, including some matching ransoms known to have been paid to the group in other cases of blackmail. The firm said, since becoming active, the wallet has received Bitcoin transactions totaling $17.5 million. Elliptic also said it's been able to gain intelligence on how DarkSide laundered prior attacks, potentially allowing authorities to locate the people behind them. Earlier, Krebs on security and others reported that DarkSide Group has decided to shut itself down after its own servers were seized and someone drained crypto from an account belonging to that group. We'll stay posted on this. AT&T and Discovery creates a media juggernaut. AT&T and Discovery to combine media businesses in a blockbuster $43 billion deal. AT&T is combining its massive media operations that include CNN, HBO, TNT, and TBS in a $43 billion deal with Discovery, the owner of lifestyle networks, including the Food Network and HGTV. The deal announced this Monday would create a separate media company with households increasingly abandoning cable and satellite TV. Broadcast media is under significant threat from Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. Faced with cord-cutting and incursions by streaming services, major broadcast media companies have retrenched and sought strength through mergers. In an all-stock deal, AT&T will receive $43 billion in a combination of cash, debt securities, and WarnerMedia's retention of certain debts. AT&T shareholder will receive stock representing 71% of the new company, and Discovery stockholders will own 29% of the new company. Less than 3 years after AT&T spent over $85 billion and millions more fending off a government challenge to buy Time Warner, one of the biggest prizes in media, the phone company has decided on a completely different strategy. WarnerMedia is run by Jason Kilar, age 50, one of the early pioneers in streaming and the first chief executive of Hulu. David Zaslav, age 60, has been the head of Discovery for 14 years and helped it grow into a reality behemoth. The transaction creates a new company bigger than Netflix or NBC Universal, and WarnerMedia and Discovery together generated more than $41 billion in sales last year, with an operating profit of over $10 billion. That would put the combined company ahead of Netflix and NBC Universal and behind the Walt Disney Company. In other words, to compete for audiences increasingly glued to Facebook, YouTube, or TikTok, media companies need to get even bigger. It could probably set off another round of media deals. Both AT&T and Discovery have invested heavily in streaming to compete with Netflix and Disney. AT&T has plowed billions into creating HBO Max, a streaming platform that now has about 20 million customers. Discovery has 15 million streaming subscribers around the world, most of them for its Discovery Plus app. The merger would also be a significant about-face for AT&T, a telecommunications giant better known for servicing fiber lines and cell towers than producing entertainment and courting Hollywood. Industry experts question AT&T's daring purchase of Time Warner at a time when cord-cutting was only accelerating. AT&T didn't know what they were buying, said a longtime Wall Street analyst. The strategy underpinning the acquisition was probably flawed. The company quickly worked to consolidate the media giant's various divisions, ultimately laying off about 2,000 employees. They were genuinely reorganizing the business to give it clarity to be able to compete with Netflix. At the same time, AT&T is no longer best positioned to continue investing in its media business. The wireless giant is one of the most heavily indebted companies, with long-term debt topping $159 billion, and that includes the $23 billion it agreed to spend in February to license additional airwaves for its 5G technology. A rival cell phone carrier, Verizon, has been shedding its media assets as it, too, has had to invest in 5G technology. This past month, it sold off Yahoo and AOL to a private equity group not long after it sold Huffington Post to BuzzFeed. The new company would create a new kind of media behemoth. One is that is still living off the fat profits of old-school cable, while spending those profits and more on streaming. AT&T had pushed into the streaming sector through HBO Max, a streaming competitor with Netflix, Apple, Disney, and Comcast. Discovery launched a standalone streaming service called Discovery Plus this year. The new company will be able to invest more in original streaming content. It will house almost 200,000 hours of programming and bring together more than 100 brands under one global portfolio, which includes DC Comics, Cartoon Network, Eurosport, Magnolia, TLC, and Animal Planet. The deal makes strategic sense for both Discovery and AT&T, with the former benefiting from being able to add CNN, Cartoon Network, and HBO Max, as well as TV rights to MLB, NBA, NFL, and other sports content to its new streaming service. Discovery Plus becomes a more relevant service for a wider group of people in the world. The deal to give up its media business marks a major shift by AT&T, which fought hard to push a transaction through back in 2018 to buy Time Warner for $85 billion, with the Justice Department trying to block the deal for anti-competitive reasons. AT&T moved to spin off its media assets will bolster the telecoms giant's balance sheet and let it focus on building out its 5G network. AT&T earlier this year also spun off satellite TV provider DirecTV, which it had bought in 2015 for $48 billion in a deal with private equity firm TPG. The deal follows a continued simplification of AT&T's assets and divestiture strategy, beginning with a spin-off of DirecTV with private equity firm TPG. Discovery President and CEO David Zaslav will lead the new company. The deal is expected to close by the middle of next year. It still needs approval from Discovery shareholders. The AT&T stockholders don't need to vote on the transaction. The first case in the United States to show that the government made Twitter silence political speech. That's unbelievable. On May the 13th, Judge Wolf issued a new order seeking amicus briefs from the supporters of the First Amendment. This case goes to the heart of what this country was founded to protect: freedom of speech, and especially political speech. Here is an excerpt from Judge Wolf's latest order. Hearing set for May the 20th. Public may zoom in. The judge's most recent order seeks experts to weigh in with amicus briefs on historic First Amendment case. On October the 30th, 2020, Federal Judge Mark Wolf declared that Dr. Shiva Ayyaduro will likely prevail on his claim in case 20-CV-11889 that the government of Massachusetts made Twitter silence him in the middle of his election campaign. This historic case is proceeding forward, and a hearing is set for May the 20th, 2021. The judge has ordered Twitter to present their position on May 20th. This case is a first in the United States that presents powerful evidence that government and Twitter are hand in glove. The case has garnered multiple victories, including surviving motions to dismiss, as well as winning the terms of its preliminary injunction, whereby the judge ordered the government to stop silencing Dr. Shiva on Twitter. On February 1st, 2021, the government violated that order. On May 10th, 2021, Judge Wolf issued an order for Twitter to appear in court on May the 20th to explain why it should not be made a co-defendant and whether the government was responsible for the February 1st, 2021 deplatforming of Dr. Shiva. This is a reminder. Google Photos Unlimited free uploads ends in a few weeks. Google's unlimited uploads for high-quality photos is ending on June 1st, 2021. That means you can only have a few weeks left to back up as many pictures as you can on the service before the new free storage limit kicks in. Google announced back in November of last year that it would be putting an end to its unlimited photo storage for non-paying users. After June 1st, any new photos or videos uploaded to Google Photos will count towards the same free 15 gigabyte of storage that all Google accounts divide across Photos, Gmail, and Drive. If you need more space, you'll need to buy additional storage. Google Photos VP wrote in the original announcement, "This change also allows us to keep pace with the growing demand for storage. And as always, we uphold our commitment to not use information in Google Photos for advertising purposes. We know this is a big shift and may come as a surprise. So we wanted to let you know well in advance and give you resources to make this easier. If you already have way more than 15 gigabytes of high-quality photos, that is to say, compressed photos weighing in at 16 megabytes or less, stored on Google's Photos, don't worry. That data won't be counted towards your free storage after this upcoming change. What's more, anything uploaded before June 1st will be grandfathered in as well. So if you use Google Photos as a free backup of non-full-res photos, now's the time to upload to your heart's content without denting your quota or wallet. Pixel smartphone owners who have enjoyed unlimited original quality photo storage with Google will also be impacted. Photos uploaded from those phones after June 1st will only be stored for free in the lower high quality and not full res. It remains to be seen whether Amazon makes any changes in the area of unlimited photo storage as well as in response to rising storage demand. The company originally launched free photo storage, including RAW photos, for ultra-affordable $12 a year back in 2015, but it killed off that plan the following year in favor of having unlimited photo storage bundled as a Prime benefit. Amazon Prime members, and now even family members, continue to enjoy free unlimited full-res photo storage and 5 gigabytes of space for videos. Southeast Energy Consultants employs work release prison inmates to make robocalls. Investigators traced a robocall that Florida reporter Chris Ingalls received on his cell phone in January back to a telemarketing call center in St. Petersburg, Florida. The investigation uncovered the caller was a Florida prison inmate who was one of at least two dozen prisoners on work release who are listed in the state registry of telemarketers in Florida State. The findings are a glaring example of the murky world of telemarketing and robocalls, which have increased dramatically. Robocalls, often computer-dialed live or recorded calls, are a constant source of irritation to people who receive them. The company is called Southeast Energy Consultants, and it has compliant alerts on file with the Better Business Bureau for harassing phone calls and for violating do-not-call requests from consumers. Southeast Energy and the companies which it provides marketing services have 610 complaints on file since January 2020 with the California Public Utilities Commission. Investigation revealed an obvious truth about robocalls. You never know who's on the other end of the line. Sometimes there are nefarious characters in these boiler rooms. They may be just out of drug rehab. They may be ex-prisoners. Telemarketers are desperate to hire anyone who's willing to stick to the script and work the phones for low pay. Documents from the state of Florida, which requires telemarketers, are registered with the Department of Agriculture, shows there are at least two dozen inmates at the St. Petersburg Work Release Center who are registered telemarketers. Why would the Florida Department of Corrections allow inmates who are prepared to return to society to hold jobs where they harass and deceive customers that they call from telemarketing boiler rooms? The Department of Florida Corrections declined requests for comments or interviews. Many telemarketers operate in a legally gray area. Except in certain circumstances, businesses that do not have your permission are not allowed to call you per the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. They are also required to honor the Federal Do Not Call Registry. According to complaints, Southeast Energy has been violating both those laws. Southeast Energy Consultant owners Brett Lister and Mike Schwegman offered the following statement. Southeast Energy Consultants has proudly provided telemarketing services for numerous clients since 2009. We have always complied in accordance to all local, state, and federal laws pertaining to our industry, including robocalls and do not call, and take them very seriously. Florida has a reputation as a hotbed for robocall operations and instituted the state registry to crack down on illegal telemarketing operations. But the agency that regulates the industry appeared surprised by the use of prison inmates. SFE Energy, which uses Southeast Energy Consultants to pitch its energy-related services, deferred to Southeast Energy Consultants for a response when contacted. How can one cut down on telemarketer calls? Register to place your phone numbers on the Federal Trade Commission Do Not Call list. Scammers will ignore the restrictions on the list, but many telemarketers will honor it. Registering will keep at least some of those calls from coming to your phone. Amazon has been pulling Chinese products from sale. If you have ever bought daily goods on Amazon, the chances are your supplies are from China. Analysts have estimated that the share of Chinese merchants represented 75% of Amazon's new sellers in January, up from 47% the year before. Chinese sellers are swarming not just Amazon, but also eBay, Wish, and Alibaba's AliExpress. The boom is in part a result of intense domestic competition in China's online retail world, which forces merchants to seek new markets. Traditional exporters are turning to e-commerce, cutting out excessive distributors. Came to a halt when several top Chinese sellers disappeared from Amazon. At least 11 accounts that originate from Greater China were suspended. Several accounts belong to the same parent firms. As it's normal for big sellers, those with more than $1 million in annual sales, to operate multiple brands on Amazon to optimize sales. Amazon stores Empower and Aukey, that's A-U-K-E-Y, are gone. In total, the suspended accounts contributed over $1 billion in gross merchandising value to Amazon. Amazon said in a statement that it has long-standing policies to protect the integrity of our store, including product authenticity, genuine reviews, and products meeting the expectation of our customers. We take swift action against those that violate them, including suspending or removing selling privileges, said an Amazon spokesperson. The consensus is that the sellers have crossed the line in conducting questionable platform practices. Amazon says it shares enforcement actions directly with selling accounts. This isn't the first time Amazon has shut down accounts over fake reviews and other behavior that violates its rules, but the scale of this wave is unprecedented. It's no doubt that Amazon needs Chinese suppliers for affordable and diverse products, of which average quality has also increased remarkably in recent years. But as competition heated up among Chinese sellers, black hat tactics that were common in Chinese e-commerce became a necessity to survive on Amazon. It's an open secret that a lot of Chinese sellers are aggressive towards marketing. One of the common tricks employed by Chinese sellers is manipulating reviews, which affect how a product is listed on Amazon. This can be done by paying real buyers to leave a positive review or sending fake orders and leaving good comments through zombie accounts. The latter approach is often delegated to agents that call themselves product review services, which offer a suite of resources to emulate real accounts, IP proxies, virtual credit cards, overseas addresses, any piece of information of identity that can help avoid suspicion from Amazon's fraud detection algorithm. Another prevalent tactic, which perhaps poses a greater existential crisis to Amazon than fake reviews, is ways to direct buyers away from Amazon from merchants' own web stores. Amazon restricts merchants from collecting sensitive buyers' information such as email, But Chinese exporters found a way around it, sending postcards to customers asking them to leave reviews on their own websites. These tricks have been around for years, and what caused the sudden attack at top sellers? Safety Detectives, a cybersecurity firm, uncover a data breach in which a trove of direct messages between Amazon sellers soliciting fake reviews from buyers. The data, which implicates more than 200,000 individuals, was hosted on a server that appears to be in China, according to Safety Detectives. The report didn't mention the name of the sellers involved. Amazon did not say whether it was their way of the data breach. It, however, assured that its users, machine learning tools, and skilled investigators to analyze over 10 million review submissions weekly and monitor all existing reviews for signs of abuse and quickly take action if they find an issue. It also works with social media sites to report bad actors who are cultivating abusive reviews outside our store. But bad actors would likely come back even after the latest episodes of crackdowns. Amazon is fighting an entire lucrative and tight-knit ecosystem of merchants and fake review services, not just a few big sellers. In recent years, Amazon has been nudging more new sellers to join and be good brands. It's getting more difficult and costly to run a business on Amazon. These challenges have encouraged hordes of exporters to diversify sales channels beyond Amazon and invest in their own Shopify-based web stores, where they get to write the rules. They are encouraged by what Shine, an independent e-commerce store that sells made-in-China apparel to overseas market, has achieved. In the first quarter, Shine was the world's second most downloaded shopping app. Just remember, whenever you're buying online, caveat emptor. The government has a program to cut your internet bill. It's called the Emergency Broadband Benefit, and it's supposed to knock $50 off monthly bills. It's the largest federal program ever to help people afford internet access. The EBB, which is the Emergency Broadband Benefit, can cut $50 off monthly internet bills and is available to tens of millions of Americans hit economically by the coronavirus pandemic. There's $3.2 billion up for grabs until the program ends, and when money runs out in the months ahead. So what is it not to like about it? All internet service providers' participation in the program is voluntary, and each ISP gets to write some of its own rules for how to hand out the money. Soon after the EBB was launched, Verizon elicited the most anger from those who were interested in the EBB. It requires customers to call a phone number to register for the EBB rather than just signing up online. And when you do, Verizon tells customers the EBB can't be used on old data plans, so they'll have to switch. That might be allowed by the letter of the law, but certainly it's not the spirit of the program. A subscriber was told his current no-contract internet service, which costs $62 a month, would need to become part of a new Verizon Fios plan that would run him $79 per month. Yes, the person would be able to save money in the short term thanks to the $50 government discount, but when the EBB program runs out, he'll have to pay more each month. Another subscriber who pays $79 per month for her internet says Verizon told her she would have to switch to a plan that would cost her closer to $95. Another subscriber still was told by two customer service representatives that she could receive the EBB discount only if she increased her current internet speed and reconfigured her TV package, too. She said the ultimate price would have depended on what video package she was forced to switch to, as well as new equipment with fees. When the EBB ends, she estimated that her overall monthly internet and TV bill would be at least $50 higher. A Verizon spokesperson said the company makes it clear on its site that the EBB can be used on only qualifying plans, and those include only its newer mix-and-match plans. Mix-and-match lets customers drop services like home phone that used to be bundled into the Verizon packages. Verizon's new deals don't mean everyone will save money, and unfortunately, Verizon isn't the only ISP saying it won't support older plans. AT&T, which also makes customers' calls to activate the EBB for home internet, says existing customers will have to select from one of a handful of options, and the plan they select will become their plan after the EBB program ends. Charter says that an extremely small percentage of customers who have legacy internet plans will have to switch to a Spectrum internet plan as part of enrolling in the EBB. Well, there's one refreshing standout was Comcast, the nation's largest ISP. If a customer is on an old plan that's not offered anymore, as long as they meet the qualification criteria for EBB. When you allow the ISP to define who qualifies, you think they're going to lose money on this? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to Office, Part 6.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for us to get back to work. Okay, yeah, okay. This is, I usually say get down to business, but you know, I am in at the end of our series, a six-part series on the post-COVID outlook on work. A year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, we all shifted from working in the office to working at home. We adapted and we had to figure out what could be done from home and what couldn't be done. We went through a lot. I've talked about in the past weeks business side decisions that have to be made before we go back to the office or as we go back to the office. I've talked about staying at home, going back if you want to or you don't want to. But now I want to talk about the hybrid model. The hybrid model is something that is going to continue with a lot of people. This is where companies, they realized that they were spending a lot on square footage for offices that people weren't using. They realized that they made a large windfall. And if they could give up their lease and move in a different direction, that they could make more money. I mean, we look at Manhattan. And some of the reports I've been seeing coming out of Manhattan about offices that are going unused, it's amazing. It's interesting. People are shifting out to moving to the rural sections of the country because they can. They're no longer tied to being in the downtown area where they've got a shorter commute, or a suburban area where they've got the longer commute. But you know, they're just looking for a little bit more escapism, whatever it is. There is going to be an analysis on a number of companies, at a number of companies rather, that they're going to be studying, are you better at working in person or at home? Were your productivity levels higher from home or higher from the office? They're going to shift you there. The smartest ones are going to find out where you excelled, and they're going to utilize you there. Hoteling is going to be a big option. Hoteling is where you go into the office and you'll get your box. And I like to call this the suitcase. You'll get your suitcase. I mean, it's a hotel. You'll get your suitcase. You'll go to a desk that they assign to you. You'll work at that desk for the day. And then you'll pack up your desk, your suitcase, and take the suitcase back, and you'll store that suitcase in an area where they've got it all set up for you. It's going to be a secure area. It might be a matter of somebody doing a coat check kind of thing, and they'll put it aside for you, and they'll just keep shifting you in and out, and then you'll work from the office. You'll take your laptop back and forth. You'll work from the office for a week, and then you'll work from home for a week. Or it might be just a matter of Mondays and Tuesdays. You'll come into the office. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you work from home, and so forth. This is actually, the hybrid model is the easiest decision because it pleases as many people as possible. There's a lot of technology that goes along with this, but a lot of that technology has been made already. That investment has been made. So they've already set up everything so you can work from home. This is really the best of both worlds for many people because you can leverage that which you like. And they may be a matter of, okay, you're going to come in. We want you in the office a matter of 1 week out of the month. The rest of the month, you can work from home. However it is, some people in the executive rooms, the boardrooms and the offices and whatever, they want to work how you want to work. They realize that there are perks for allowing you to escape your home problems for a short while each day. But for other people, those continued family ties are the perks that drive you, that make you feel better. They realize leveraging this as a perk may actually save them more money in that they don't have to necessarily pay you a higher salary. Let's face it. Salaries and wages, they've gone, as a general rule, down over the course of the last year or so. That's because there's a lot more people in the workplace. So they're realizing that they can save money, but they can also leverage a perk which they're already in a position to offer. So yes, introverts, they may enjoy their alone time. Extroverts can hang out with each other. And this is exciting for them because they're going to see increased productivity across the board. This is why we give out perks as employers. This is why we take these perks as employees. So this is all good. Either way, in the hybrid model, I want you to make sure that you are crossing the boundaries of your choice. If you're given the chance to stay at home more often, do so. Don't get stuck in the rut of staying at home. Likewise, if you're given the choice, if it's your choice to go into the office on a more increased basis, I don't want you to get stuck in that rut either. Monitor your own productivity. Monitor your own effectiveness to the company. Take it from an unbiased approach. Take it, find different numbers, metrics we call them. Take those numbers and determine, are you getting more done at the office or at home? And leverage that for, yes, future reviews. Either way, we'll look at this. All the way throughout all of these, understand that change is inevitable and just embrace the change. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. DarkSide offers a ransomware platform for, quote-unquote, approved cyber criminals. DarkSide is a new ransomware attack that started at the beginning of August 2020. It is managed by former affiliates of other ransomware campaigns that extorted money who decided to come up with their own ransomware platform. So who or what is DarkSide? According to Intel 471, a security company that surveys the teeming cybercriminal ecosystems on the internet, DarkSide first appeared in November of 2020 on a Russian language hacker forum advertising for partners for ransomware service. What they were advertising was a platform that approved cyber criminals could use to infect companies with ransomware and carry out negotiations and payments with victims. And this is how they advertise themselves. We are a new product on the market, but that does not mean that we have no experience and came from nowhere. We received millions of dollars of profit by partnering with other well-known crypto lockers. We created DarkSide because we didn't find the perfect product for us. Now we have it. Well, like other ransomware used in targeted attacks, DarkSide not only encrypts the user's data, but also exfiltrates data from the compromised servers. But unlike other bad actors in ransomware, you won't believe this, DarkSide has a code of conduct. Not long afterwards, DarkSide software is found to be behind several ransomware attacks on manufacturers and legal firms in Europe and the United States. According to Intel 471, in March of 2021, which is just a few months ago, DarkSide introduced a number of new features in an effort to attract new affiliates. These included versions for targeting Microsoft Windows and Linux-based systems, enhanced encryption settings, a fully fledged and integrated feature built directly into the management panel that enabled affiliates to arrange calls meant to pressure victims into paying ransoms, and a way to launch a distributed denial of service. Note the reference made to management panel. In conventional software packages, this would be called a dashboard, a visual tool to enable non-technical managers to run a complex program without knowing anything about the coding. The panel also seems to provide scripts for conducting negotiations with victims. In the ransomware marketplace, traders are anxious to establish reputations for reliability and quality. It shows that cybercrime has been industrialized and that they use methods and economic concepts that one would use if studying any line of business. They see what they do as a low-risk activity with very high profit margins, and they operate in a network world. The significance of the Colonial Pipeline hack is its confirmation of cybercrime as a major new industry. There may be honor among thieves, as the saying goes, but they still are concerned about their online reputations. As DarkSide claims, it has occasionally donated some of its profits to charity, suggesting an interesting new interpretation of corporate responsibility. DarkSide announcement also stated what kinds of entities they do not attack, and that they only attack companies that could pay the demanded amount, an amount they claim that they determined by researching the companies they attack. Even though their conduct is certainly illegal, they have not only kept their word about who they will not attack, but they've actually expanded the exclusions. So 7 months after they announced their launch, what, if anything, has changed for them? They recommend using your insurance to pay the ransomware. DarkSide first press release in which they stated that they were not out to kill companies. The following areas that they won't touch or are prohibited is medicine. Well, only hospitals, any palliative care organizations, nursing homes, companies that develop and participate largely at the supply chain level in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccine, and funeral services, with morgues, crematoriums, and funeral homes excluded. They also included education, universities, and schools, the public sectors, municipalities, any government bodies, and nonprofit organizations of charities and associations. They also specifically prohibit any actions that damage the reputation of the product are prohibited. Any work in the CIS is prohibited, including Georgia and Ukraine. It is forbidden to transfer the account to third parties, and it is forbidden to use other lockers in one project. So unlike what we saw with some entities refusing to commit to leave medical entities alone or reneging on pledges, DarkSide has consistently prohibited attacks on medical entities as defined in their rules. They also have a more extensive exclusion list than any other group. There will be some who argue, so what? They're still criminals. Well, having said that, and while their intentions may sound noble in excluding medical, DarkSide doesn't consider medical targets likely to pay. When asked if this code of conduct will that change when the pandemic ends? DarkSide stated that there are several reasons why they do not attack medical institutions. One, they may lead to aggravation of health problems and the death of people, which is unacceptable to them. In the encryption of medical institutions, they lose a history of patient diseases, a schedule of operations, including due to the loss of test results, which is now digitized, and they feel that such companies do not pay a ransom. That statement seemed to directly contradict what was reported at the same time. Last year, when we were told that hospitals pay 80 to 90% of the time because they simply have no choice. Have they stopped paying as often? Hospitals in Germany, Belgium, and France have been in the news in recent months as victims of ransom attacks. But are they paying? And are those who are attacking them making demands that far exceed cyber insurance? Have the criminals gotten so greedy that more victims are now refusing to pay? DarkSide did acknowledge that some things may change after a pandemic, but did not specify. In an October press release, DarkSide revealed that they had made donations to some charities. It did not get a positive response from the security community, members of the forum where it was discussed, or the general public. Concerned that entities might reject their donations if they knew the source, DarkSide announced that in the future, their donations would be anonymous. What they said was that at that time, they had not considered it as an advertising move. Donations were really shipped to help people. We do not know about unpleasant consequences that in the end happened with the money. But no one returned it to us as the money was sent through a mixer. Well, sometimes we sacrifice money for enlightenment for various charitable funds. And here's what DarkSide did say. Yes, sometimes we sacrifice money for enlightenment with various charitable funds. Not everyone who wanted to give money to accept Bitcoin. But mostly we are anonymously supporting several open source projects on anonymity on the internet. Well, looks like it's a big business with ransomware. Pretty soon they'll be talking about return on investment and cost of operation. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival, the original personal computer festival, was virtual this year. It took place on March the 20th, 2021. It was a 100% virtual event via Zoom teleconferencing. There were talks and forums via Zoom during the course of the day, and there were 10 simultaneous event tracks. Jerry Foster, CTO and co-founder, Plex Systems, delivered the TCF 2021 keynote speech, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. The TCF session recordings, the program grid, and the program guide are free and available for download on the website tcf-nj.org. Donations are welcome to offset expenses. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Dazzling Dinners Through Technology and Culinary Creativity, Thursday, May the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, June 3rd, 2021 at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, June 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, June 10th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, June 11th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.